new recently. I've been reading a book about evolution, and I came across a pretty strange sentence by Charles Darwin, who said, "You know, the peacock's tail makes me sick." And I thought, what does that mean? And it turns out that the problem with the peacock's tail was that it made Darwin's theory of survival of the fittest seem really wrong. Why did this incredibly elaborate and very heavy psychedelic blue tail evolve when survival of the fittest means that the strongest survive, not the most handsome, not the most beautiful? And it was really a problem, because it meant that females of the species were actually making all the decisions. And according to Darwin's theory of sexual selection, if the female bird liked the tasseled crest more than the tufted crest, for whatever reason, let's say the tasseled crest sparkled more than sunlight, then the engine of evolution would start to manufacture lots and lots of tasseled crests. Then, if for some reason the female decided, no, actually, the tasseled crests aren't really that beautiful after all, let's go back to the tufted ones, then the whole process would just reverse. And this was a kind of nightmare for Darwin, because this was Victorian England, where women were considered somewhat frail and flighty, a bit hysterical, fainting at the drop of a hat. Maybe because their corsets cut off their entire air supply. But they would be sitting at the dinner table and just slowly run out of air, and then just slide down under the table. So they were definitely not up to the job of single-handedly determining the direction of evolution. So for Darwin, who's a rather mousy dresser himself, the peacock was a complete nightmare. I see the real reason that the Catholic Church does not support scientific research has to do with certain potentially dangerous discoveries. Like, what if they find out there are lots of planets just like ours? Countless Earths just like ours? And if that's true, then there's the possibility that there could be a pope on quite a few of these planets. And so the big question is then, which pope would be the main pope? The biggest pope? The oldest pope? The pope with the biggest, brightest, blue tail? And then again, why call this planet Earth? It's just so formal. Why not call it the planet Dirt? It's more organic, funkier, like we are. There would be Mars and Venus and Dirt. And a good example, celebrate Dirt Day. And people would promise to move heaven and dirt for you. Do you know, it's amazing how much of the so-called real world comes down to words, to definitions. I'm thinking right now of Israel, where they solve a lot of problems by just changing the words a bit. For example, there's a religious law that forbids raising pigs on the soil of Israel, which is a problem for some of the non-religious farmers. And the solution? They build platforms, and they put the pigs up on the platforms, so they're not actually technically standing on Israeli soil. You know, I'm thinking of the new law in the United States, the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. And this was a law that was signed by the president on New Year's Eve. And it gives the military the right to arrest and detain American citizens indefinitely without charge. And this law also seems to hang on a precedent set in the Civil War, when there was a need to be able to arrest and try citizens as enemies and traitors. And so to make this legal, the whole country was redefined as a battleground. Yes, this place that used to be called a country is once again the battleground. And no one really knows what that could possibly mean. And I'm thinking of Paul Revere, who went galloping through all the little New England towns in the American Revolution, warning the citizens that the British troops were coming. And he's galloping along, yelling, "The British are coming! The British are coming!" And the people of New England are sitting there smoking in cottages and thinking, "Wait a second. I'm British. You're British. Isn't Paul British? Pretty much we're basically all British here. So exactly who is coming?" Now it seems like we've been waiting for a couple of hundred years now for the enemy to show up. And since they never did, we finally decided that we might be the enemy ourselves.
Thank you.
dreamed that the country was declared a battlefield. Or at least, I think I dreamed. Of the memories and dreams being what they are. Such time-filled interpretations of places and things. And then there's the future which stretches out in front of us. Like down on Wall Street. Where buying and selling futures is the main business. Buying and selling things that don't exist yet. Have not been made. Things that have only been thought about. And it's these thoughts, these predictions, that are for sale. And it is the slight chance that these thoughts could one day be made into things that keeps the market spinning and spinning and spinning. Spinning, spinning, spinning. Notice the length of the things you see when your eyes are closed. I think it's phosphine. The reddish patterns, the little stripes and dots and glowing patches and checks and blurry little lines you see when you close your eyes. And no one knows what these are, really. A way to see light without the presence of actual light. Activity brought on by sound sometimes, or random electrical or magnetic firing. No one knows their purpose. Sometimes phosphines are called prisoner's cinema. Some kind of eternal, plotless, avant-garde, animated movie. Or maybe they're just screensavers that go on endlessly rotating so your brain won't go to sleep. But it's weird, you know, after all this time, 30,000 years of human civilization, we still have no idea why we dream. Of course, there are lots of theories. And one theory of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, has to do with dreaming. Now SIDS, or crib death, is the mysterious phenomenon of the death of a baby, which just suddenly stops breathing. For no apparent reason. And according to the theory, the baby dies during REM sleep. A period when dreams of the past are the most intense. And these dreams are from before he was born. Before he began to breathe. And the dreams are so real. That the baby just stops breathing. You know, last year on my 63rd birthday, I had a sudden realization that I had been asleep for 1/3 of my life. I'm the kind of person who sleeps an average 8 hours. I'm the kind of person who says, yeah, I only need a couple of hours and I'm fine, ready to go. No, I am the kind of person who would like to get in a good 18 or 19 hours every night, if at all possible. But anyway, on this birthday, I suddenly realized that I had been asleep for 1/3 of my life, which was 21 years. Now, what have I been doing all that time? Of course, suddenly my dream self was 21, officially an adult, who, if she chose, could drink martinis and vogue, or she could just manage, you know, to wake up. Ah, but dreams being what they are, it was complicated. Suddenly, there were also 21 years of dreams to remember, a whole lifetime of dreams. To look back on, starting with the childhood dreams of candy, and later, the baffling dreams of being lost in school hallways and airports, and the ecstatic dreams of the additional rooms that you suddenly remember are part of your house, the big sunroom, the studio with a white piano, filled the so-called relatives you never met, singing those hideous show tunes.
Oh, but memories be what they are. The dream house keeps shrinking and expanding. I dreamed that the United States was called a battleground. And dreams being what they are, the whole country just started to look like one. And now that the presidential elections are coming up once again, we are once again in the season of stories. Each candidate will stand up and tell a story about the past or the future, and we will vote for the one whose story we like the best. The one with the best story. Or maybe we vote for him for no actual reason, but just because we prefer him. Or maybe we just keep voting for the one with the biggest, brightest, bushiest, bluest
It's me.
And then the good news. And the good news is that we have so many regrets. Because when you think about it, if we didn't have regrets, we wouldn't have all that much music. And like the great Willie Nelson said, almost everybody in the world ends up with the wrong person. That's what makes the jukebox spin. Yeah, that's what makes the jukebox spin. This is the pure, illusory body, resting in the appearance of emptiness, basking in the appearance of emptiness, the emptiness. You know the progress bars at the bottom of your computer screen. They creep along and show you how much time is left for the download. Now, wouldn't it be great to have these progress bars in real life? So while you're having a conversation, for example, you know exactly how much longer it would go on. And you could put the punchline at the end, and not too early, or way too late, the way they usually are. You know how awkward it is when you've already said the punchline and you just keep standing there awkwardly clearing your throat. Yeah, get out, get out, get out, get out, get out, get out. Get out soon. Yeah, get up, get up, get up, get up, get up, get up. Get up soon. You know, they say people don't change, but they do, they do, they do. They get older. They join the army. They lose interest in certain sports. They move to different cities. Yeah, get up, get up, get up. Yeah, get up, get up, get up, get up, get up, get up. We caught in time. We miss our dead friends. And we watch as they turn into stories and then into shorter anecdotes. He was such a great guy. And then finally, into pure love.
We didn't know what he stood for. And then Moses came down with the 12 tablets, and he broke them, and they shattered into thousands of pieces. And it's hard to remember how any of the laws went together in what order it ever begins to be. It was impossible to put the pieces. Memories be what they are.
You know, a few weeks ago. I went out to New Jersey to see the tent city near the little town of Lakewood. And there are thousands of these tent cities all over the United States now. And more people lose their jobs and their houses, and they just move out to the surrounding woods. And I thought, you know, I wonder what these places look like. So I decided to visit Lakewood, and the day we arrived was a very bright, sunny morning in November. And we walked down the main street, which is a muddy rut, bordered with tents of all kinds. A circus tent, some top tents, a few teepees, a large army tent, and several tents with white picket fences and flower pots around them, and lots of small kennels filled with pit-billed puppies growling and snapping. And we could hear the sound of a generator buzzing somewhere and wood being chopped. And there were huge wood piles everywhere you looked, and lots of smoke stinging your eyes. And I was thinking, you know, maybe it would probably have been more realistic to have come on a day when it was really cold and dreary. The kind of New Jersey cold that could shrink your face and make your skin feel too small and make living in the woods a nightmare. But the weather that day was warm, and camping out didn't really seem to be all that bad. And there were a lot of people sitting around on logs or folding chairs in front of their tents. And we waved to a few of them, kind of self-conscious, "Hey, how's it going?" kind of wave, but most of them just ignored us or seemed maybe too exhausted to even look up. Then suddenly, a woman sprinted out of the clearing in the trees and she said, "Hello, I'm Jessie, and if you'd like, I can show you around in case you want to meet anyone at all, or see the watering system, or the chickens." And then in the middle of the sentence, she just stopped talking, and she looked down at the ground, and she said, "Yes, the chickens, and I don't know why, and then She started to sob. And I'm looking around, and there are lots of chickens running around everywhere in the bushes. I was trying to see if there was something wrong with the chickens that might be making her cry. But they seemed like regular chickens. A little feral, if you can say that about chickens. Sort of running in weird circles and then dashing off into the underbrush. A couple more minutes went by, and she's still crying. And then trying to stop, and she said, "You know, I'm so sorry, I just get so emotional. It's not the chickens, if I could only end it." And then she went back to crying. And this time, the crying lasted even longer. And I just spent the time looking around at all the small, tattered, brown leaves still hanging up in the trees. Now, a few minutes later, she stopped crying. And she told me that she was the tech town social worker, and she was there to take care of people and help them adjust to their new life in the woods, and she'd been living there for 5 years, since the beginning of the town, and that sometimes she got to thinking how horrible it would be to be there all the time, but since she was there all the time, it sounded like kind of a weird thing to say. And then she started to cry again. And she said, Okay, so this is the tour, and so let's go to meet Marilyn, and you should meet Marilyn and John. They're really great townspeople, and you'll really like them." And she led the way through the trees to a clearing filled with pots and pans and chickens and rusting plows and pumps and old car barns. And then Marilyn came running out of her tent, and she said, "Hello! Hi, how are you? How have you been?" As if we were old friends, and Marilyn was like someone you knew from down the road, except that most of her teeth were missing, and her hands were a strange, shiny, polished black that looked like the kind of hands that medieval people or cave people would have. "Now, I'm sorry you can't meet John right now, because John's out for the moment," she said, and it was hard to imagine what out meant in the woods when everybody was pretty much out all the time. But in any case, she was keeping up the formalities, and she said, "But please come and see the new birdhouses that I'm making for the Christmas fair." So we went over to the pop tent she was using for her workshop, and it was crammed with old shingles and glue and rusty tools and all the things she used to make the birdhouses. And the houses looked like miniature Hansel and Gretel style liquid houses. And Marilyn said she hoped that they would sell really well at the upcoming Christmas fair. Where the tent town people sold the craft projects they made to the people who still lived in the town. And Jessie, the social worker, who was in the pup tent, started to cry again. And I began to realize that this was not a hardened bureaucrat. And during the rest of the tour, she cried as she pointed things out, and she cried as she introduced people, and gradually I noticed that most of the people who lived there seemed to be kind of used to her constant breakdowns, and that they were all taking care of her and protecting her. Sometimes teasing her, "You can't chop wood, you're too emotional, you'll chop your leg off, ha ha ha." And suddenly I realized that she wasn't a social worker at all, but someone who wished she was a social worker, who saw herself as a social worker, and that no one was in charge here. At all. Now the other side of camp was really chaotic. And garbage was strewn all over around the tents, and you could hear shouts and arguments going on. And the chickens lived in tents too at night, but more and more often they were spending their nights up in the trees. And they were adapting to the woods. Now I had never seen chickens fly, but hey, who knew chickens can fly? They sort of flap their way up to the upper branches and they sit up there like they're impersonating owls or blackbirds. And it's really strange. Like some newly evolved species of tree-dwelling chickens. And Marilyn said, "Now, aren't those chickens lovely up there? And what a beautiful day. Well, thank you so much for coming. It's been a real pleasure to spend time with you, and I'm sorry you missed meeting John, and maybe next time I know you. Join me, and I'm sure you'll look forward to it." And we said, "Yes, okay then. Thanks. Next time. We'll see you again, like. Next time." You know, like some of the people with advanced Alzheimer's. It's odd how they can still seem to function on a certain social level. How they still have a certain social glue. "Have a nice day," they say. And their minds are almost gone. Ripped apart. And they have no idea who you are. And you hope at the end of your life there would be a few flashes of wisdom or bravery or wonder. But instead, what seems to be left for them are the small pleasantries left from a lifetime of politeness. "Have a nice day," and a really pleasant afternoon. Not that we knew how to make it go. This landscape. This fire. This fire escape. Come down. Come down. Come down. This fire. Words that with the word "the" in front of them. The dark, the war, the future, the light, the truth. This fire. heart center. Mind dissolves into space, and space into luminosity, bright and empty. If you see something, say something. But what should you actually say? Officer, there's something not quite right about that person over there. Or, officer, I have to say there's something wrong about the way that suitcase is sitting in the middle of the spaceship. Or, actually, you, officer, there's something not quite right about you. Something slippery around the edge. Like you might be made of something else, something not quite real. Something that just might melt down right in front of me into an officer size puddle. This landscape. This fire escape. Come down. It's fine. Now this light at the center, exploding at the heart center, like a suitcase left in the middle of the train station. To live in the gap between the moment that is expiring. The one that is arising, luminous and empty. This fire escape. Come down, come down. A dream like mine perceives a dream. always wondered what it would be like to see the way a dog sees. Now, these pictures were made by my 12-year-old rat terrier named Lola. And they were done on these small drawing boards that use orange plastic sheets and static. And she would scratch on the plastic and make these abstract paintings. And then you peel the plastic up and you erase them and then you just make new ones. And I like them a lot because they look a lot like phosphines. The patterns you see when you close your eyes. Now just a word about rat terriers. They have really good hearing. And they're the breed that sits in front of the RCA gramophone, his master's voice breed. Lola Bell sat in the studio with me through a lot of record projects, and she never seemed to be bored. Let's listen to that cello track for the 70th time. Yeah, great idea. Let's do that. Now, terriers are also very social dogs. So walking her in the West Village in New York is extremely social. Now, everybody knew her, and they would yell out, "Hey, Lola Bell!" And when I say everybody, I mean Kurt, who has the Austrian restaurant on the corner, and Sassy, the dog trainer who lives down the block, and our neighbor, the patron Julian, who lives across the street, and then lots of other people I'd never met who just seemed to know her for whatever unknown reason. Anyway, walking in the village was basically like shopping. She had a tab in several stores, and she would pick her rounds, and she'd stop here or there and get a treat or a toy. Now, Lola Bell was a mom dog, and she came from one of the puppy mills that grind out dogs and then just sell them in batches and moms. And she was bought by a couple who were in the middle of a divorce, and as it turns out, no one could take her. The woman didn't want her, and the husband didn't want her, and the boy wanted her, but nobody wanted the boy. So it was one of these complicated messes, and so the man took Lola with him to Canada, where he spent a month kayaking and thinking it all through, and crying and talking to himself and other invisible people. And Lola rode up on the bow of the kayak, perched on the front, leading the way, as the man paddled along and sobbed his heart out, and I think that was where she learned the great skill of empathy. And also, where she learned what our Buddhist teacher keeps trying to emphasize. You should try to learn how to feel sad without being sad. Which is really a lot harder than it seems. How to feel sad without being sad. Well, eventually, Lola Bell got sick and she lost her eyesight. And for some reason, she didn't do well at all. She just froze in place. She couldn't move. So we found a woman, a trainer, who said she could help, and she said, "Well, I taught my dogs to play piano." And we said, "You did? Maybe teach our dog to play piano." And so she did. And she played every day for 2 years. And she got reasonably good. And we set up keyboards on the floor, and she used a lot of the same samples and electronics that, kind of like that equipment over there that I'm using. And she made a Christmas record, which was, it was pretty good. And she also did some benefit concerts for other animals and animal rights organizations. Anyway, as I mentioned, Lola Bell got very sick. And we had to spend a lot of time with vets. And they all wanted to give you this speech they had prepared about pain, which was something like, "Of course you don't want her to be in pain, and so you just give her a shot and you put her to sleep, and then you give her another shot, and she stops breathing." And every time they would begin the speech, I would say, "Listen, I know you want to give this speech, and that you've rehearsed this speech, but to really listen, I'm not going to do this." But they would still try to give the speech anyway. And the more I thought about this, the more I realized that the whole healthcare system in the United States, for people and animals, is really dedicated to not feeding very much of anything. And at the end, the main goal is to end life with a certain kind of precision and professionalism, and the least amount of mess for everyone. Anyway, I called a couple of people for advice, Father Pierre, Catholic priest, and also our teacher of local Buddhist Trinpoche. And they both said basically the same thing. Animals are like people. They approach death, and then they back away. And then they approach it. And it's a process, and it takes a while. And you have no right to take that away from them. And they also said basically the same thing your Jewish grandmother would say. Get some really good painkillers, and get some really good food, and above all, don't leave her. Go and get her from the hospital. So, he did. Now, the Rinpoche that gave us this advice was the son of a teacher who was at my friend Gordon's death. Now, Gordon Nutter Clark was a sculptor who did lots of kinds of things. And one of his most well-known works was called Splitting, in which he sawed a huge house in half. And he was a minimalist, and there was a lot of very advanced theory about why he cut houses in half, although none of his theories talked about his parents' divorce or how he might have felt when his twin brother Sebastian jumped to his death out of his window. Anyway, when Gordon got sick, he decided to make his death very social, and so he invited his friends to come to the hospital. And he had only 24 hours left to live, the amount of time that his system was breaking down. And he decided to spend this time reading to his friends. And when he died, there were two lamas on either side. And when he stopped breathing, they began shouting into his ear. And the Tibetans believe that hearing is the last sense to go. So after the heart stops, and you're flatlined with no brain activity, and the eyes go out. The hammers in the ears are still working, and so they shout instructions from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, also called the Great Liberation Through Hearing. And they yelled, Gordon, you're dead. You're dead now. And when they give instructions, you see two lights, and one is near you and one is very far away, and don't go to the nearer, go to the far away one, and so on and so on. Now Lodabelle died, and according to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, all creatures then spend 49 days in the bardo. And the bardo is a place, or really a process, that lasts 49 days as the mind dissolves, and as the Tibetans believe, the spirit, or let's say the energy, prepares to take another life form. And so I did some quick math. And I realized that if she was going to be in the bardo for 49 days, she would be reborn on my birthday, which seems really, really, really unlikely. That of all days, her new birthday would be the exact same day as mine. Now, I'm a kind of believer in magic math, and I realize it's pretty superstitious, but you know, even though most people who probably don't think they're very superstitious are actually pretty superstitious on some level. For example, would you wear the sweater of a serial killer? I mean, if someone said, okay, here's a sweater and it belongs to so-and-so the serial killer, I mean, would you wear it? A lot of people would say, you know, well, I don't know. That's such a great idea. Anyway, I spent the next 49 days keeping track of what might be going on in the bardo. Now, actually, lots of things happened last year during those 49 days. On May 2nd, Osama bin Laden was killed and joined the bardo. And then, On May 22nd, there was a prediction by a U.S. religious group that the world is going to end. And obviously, this would have been like a massive event with everyone from the whole world entering the Bardo simultaneously. It would have been like really apocalyptic. And then, of course, like most things, it didn't happen. Because, in fact, most things that could happen do not happen. Anyway, the thing that's forbidden in the Tibetan Book of the Dead is crying. Crying is not allowed because it's supposedly confusing to the dead. And you don't have to summon them back because they actually can't come back. So, no crying. Now this was hard to do until the Rinpoche said, every time you think of her, you should give something away or do something kind. And I said, but then I'd be giving things away nonstop. And he said, so? Now, I've known a lot of humans who have died. My father, my mother, some of my friends. And a lot of the time it was complicated by things like guilt. I should have called her. Oh, why didn't I do this? Or why didn't I do that? And soon it becomes more about you and your many inadequacies than the person who died. But with a dog's death, it's simpler. They just disappear and are suddenly gone in this heartbreaking, physical, wordless way. And you just don't know what to do with your feelings about that. And I finally understood that there's a relationship between love and death that I'd never understood before. And that the purpose of death is the release of love. And think about it, a whole lot of what's good in the world comes from this dilemma. There's little Timmy, who's not even a year old. He dies of cancer, and his parents are distraught. They don't know what to do with their love for him. And so, they build a giant wing in a hospital for cancer research for their children. And I have to say that my dog taught me more about this process than people did. But thanks to technology, Lola Bell is still around, and she's got quite a few YouTube clips. And in case you want to look her up, you just Google Lola Bell Music Dog. And meanwhile, I'm going to show you a couple of short clips. Dolphins as well. And now we're going to look at another short clip, which is a different kind of look. It's a little bit like moodier sort of approach to the music. So, just a different. Thank you. going to sing like a violin, and so a while ago, I figured out how to do this. And this little device is called a pillow speaker, and you put it under your pillow at night so you can do things like learn German in your sleep. Now this never worked for me. I always just woke up and I'm feeling good. But soon I like to tinker with small things, and I'm the kind of person who gets a kind of thrill out of putting electronics in my mouth. So this is a short song for fiddle speaker, and it goes like this.
Bye.
one view of life. A snake came walking in the twilight. He was leaning on his ivory cane. There's a certain sharpness to a knife or a diamond. Watch it glitter. Are you a great desire? You can create longing and desire by creating false memories. This is how all the great perfumes get made. And bought. And so. For example, imagine Paris on a cloudy afternoon. November. Leaves swirling around the monuments. People rushing along wearing elegant white silk scarves. Little dogs hurrying along the gray river Seine. And the bars are opening. And they're full of golden light and clever, stylish people. And look, over there. There's Catherine Deneuve, and she's looking so good these days, so glamorous. And you're there too with your best friend in your favorite small, dark wood panel bar, the Twisted Coriander. And in fact, you've never been to Paris. But you miss it anyway. More than any other place. You've never been. You know, actually, there was a time long ago, in the 18th century, when the French loved the Americans. Yes, and when the French loved the Americans, they expressed it by inventing 13 toasts of 13 different wines, toasting the 13 colonies. Ah, yes, those were the days. They even admired our puritanical ways. And they made some ballets for us. And making ballets for people in other countries was often their way of showing appreciation. Let's create a ballet for the Americans, they said. Créons un ballet pour les Américains. And so, they did. And in the ballets, the dancers wore costumes made of very heavy, authentic American wool. And the ballerinas could barely get off the ground. And the huge hairdos were further handicapped since they were sculpted to look like huge coonskin caps with long raccoon tails. Now that is how much they liked us. Those days.
himself. He was only a picture book, really. Not a real place. Hell. The sky. The land.
You know, as a child, I spent a lot of time trying to imagine things that had never happened in the history of the world. And for some reason, this was very important to me. Things that had never, ever happened. And I'd go out into the woods and make a fort and get a bunch of oak leaves and roll them into oak leaf cigarettes. Go into the fort and light them and pick up various improbable scenarios. For example, a man is walking along a road, and just as he looks up into the sky, which is filled with dense swirling snow, a duck flying above him has a heart attack, and he falls right on top of the man and kills him. Things like that. And sometimes I thought, actually, you know, maybe that's already happened before. And I would try to add more details to make it even less likely. And sometimes these things would lead to other related questions. Like, what if everything just stopped? The tides, and the waves, and then the sky froze. What then? Or questions like, is it true that on Mars, the cliffs are really 40 feet high? Let's say, are you perhaps made of glass? Should a dog aspire to the heart of the Buddha, to live in the gap between the moment that is expiring and the one that is arising? There you'll see. Real down. Falling through your mind. In glittering pieces. And when you close your eyes, what do you see?